I'll just say that Limud is a wonderful thing, and I feel very appreciative to be here, and you should all feel very appreciative not to be here with my session, per se, but Limud in general, and it's important that these things get said, so there I've said it. It's one of the few rays of hope for the future of the Jewish people. As I like to say when I'm at Limud, I'm Rabbi Sachs, but not the Rabbi Sachs you've all been waiting for so long. I'm Jeffrey Sachs. I've come to you from Yerushalayim. Among the different things that I do there, work in education, work in online learning. Somehow, over the past number of years, I became something of an expert in the writings of Shai Agnon, S.Y. Agnon. We are now moving into the 50th anniversary of his winning the Nobel Prize in 1966. Next December will be the 50th anniversary, and at least in Yerushalayim, I don't know, in other academic fora around the world, there'll be a whole slew of events and conferences and programming and things to mark this event. When Agnon won the Nobel in 66, he... I hope there's enough sheets. If not, people can share. If people have the app, the sheets are there in the handbook on the app, and you can look at them on your tablet or whatever it is. When he won the Nobel in 66, he was, of course, the first Israeli to win a Nobel in any category. We've gone on to win lots of Nobel Prizes for other things. And he was the first, and to this day, only Hebrew author to win a Nobel Prize. Of course, many, many Jews have won the Nobel. Every year when they announce the Nobel Prizes, that email goes around with, you know, Jews make up 1/100 millionth of world population, but we've won 99% of the prizes. And like, you know, when they announce, this year in chemistry, the award goes to Seamus O'Feeney. So we say, probably not one of ours. But if it's, you know, Yonkel Goldberg, we say, yes. And if it's something in the middle, you run to Wikipedia to check. So when he won the Nobel, he was the first and to this day only Hebrew author. Of course, many Jews have won for writing, even for writing very Jewish literature, but in other languages. Who's the most Jewish? Besheva Singer won for writing in Yiddish. Saul Bellow won. It's hard to say that Saul Bellow is not a deeply Jewish writer, but for writing in English. Agnon had a very long life. On the back of the sheet, I just put, you know, for my own ego, I put a list of some of the other things I'm going to be talking about while here. I don't expect that people are going to be following me around all week. But just to put it in context, today we're going to talk a little bit about the impact, things that happened in his early years. This afternoon, I'm going to be talking about the kind of transition that he tried to capture in his writing, between the old world and the new world. The old world, not only the world of European Jewry, Eastern European Jewry, and the new world of the land of Israel, but the transition that took place principally in the condition of faith. What does it mean to be a person of faith in the modern world? What does it mean that we no longer have emunah pshuta, simple faith, that people of faith today, I'm not here speaking denominationally and which synagogue you pray or do not pray in, but people of faith today have to work for their faith in a way that was not true in the pre-modern condition. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be showing some films, contemporary Israeli films, to show the influence, the ongoing influence of Agnon in Israeli culture, which is not always clearly understood. People consume all types of cultural products without knowing where it came from. So I want to come back now full circle to talk a little bit about where this came from. Agnon was born, I trust the word of biography is in place? Yes? Agnon was born in 1887, although he always said he was born in 1888, in a little town, not a shtetl, don't think Fiddler on the Roof. Don't think Tevye, right? He was born in a little town in what today is the western Ukraine, but then were the eastern reaches of Galicia, which was then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was a much more sophisticated, by standards of the day, Jewish community than what some of our, when we flatten all of our stereotypes of the old world into a kind of pastiche or a type of stereotype. It was a much more sophisticated environment by the standards of the day. And who doesn't have a sheet? Right. So apparently there aren't enough. If you have the app, you can access it on the app, or you can sit next to someone who does. In 1908, Agnon, who grew up in a completely traditional environment, he went to Cheder. He learned, after a few years of Cheder study, he learned one-on-one with his father, who was a Rav, but worked in the fur trade to make his living, and would spend many, 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 many hours in the very well-endowed Beit Midrash of his town, where he put his prodigious photographic memory to use, just sitting and learning and reading. At the age of around 19, he went on Aliyah, arriving in Yafo with the...
What was the name of the place?
A little town called Buchach. Which he satirizes in much of his writing under the literary name Shibush. Buchach, Shibush. Shibush, of course, means mixed up, muddled, confused. So he kind of like lives in Confusedville. So 1908, he shows up in Jaffa, as part of the Second Aliyah. And like so many other young men of that period, when he arrives, he has taken off his Yarmulke, and has adopted at least what externally appears to be the secular lifestyle of the pioneering settlers of the Second Aliyah. He was never a pioneer. He never went out to drain ditches and to dig ditches or to drain swamps or things like that. He worked first as a scribe, as a clerk in the Beit Din, in the court in Jaffa, and he very quickly did everything that he could do to dedicate himself full-time to writing. In the first year that he's there, he writes a short story called Agunot, which is not really about Agunot in the contemporary sense of the term. The way we use the term Aguna is not technically correct. An aguna in halachic literature is a woman whose husband has gone off to a voyage at sea and never comes back. Maybe the ship went down at sea, there's no GPS, we don't know what happened to it, and she's unfortunately chained or anchored to this missing husband. The way we use, I mean, that case still exists in a very small amount of cases today, but when we colloquially use the term aguna, we know where the husband is. He's just a rotten, obnoxious, vile guy, and if we could convince him to do the right thing and divorce his wife, she would be free of these chains. But that is not the technically accurate use of the term. Agnon's use of the term was neither this nor that. It was about the kind of psychic chain between two lovers who are bound together emotionally by their love, but yet something is blocking it. They can't get it together. They're chained together, but yet they can't fulfill their love. And this was a theme that repeats itself throughout his long career, throughout his long in many different genres. None of his love stories end. They lived happily ever after. Now, what is this a metaphor for? The agunot? These two people that love each other, but yet they live at a distance, not necessarily a physical distance, but their marriage, their love, their relationship is not what it is designed to be. Anyone? So, well, it is a kind of star-crossed lovers. No. Picking up on the Midrashic idea of the Jewish people and God as bride and groom, Agunot becomes a metaphor. Well, it reads on the surface level as this story of star-crossed love. But it becomes a metaphor for the relationship of God and the Jewish people in exile. If God and the Jewish people are married, if Matan Torah, if Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah was the marriage ceremony. If midrashically holding the mountain above our head was a type of chuppah, well, we need a little marriage therapy. We should, go on to one of those talk shows and talk about our problems. Because our marriage is not in good shape, the Jewish people and God. Because he kind of kicked us out of the house. And although technically we're still married, it's more akin to a kind of separation. The 2,000 years of exile has been a story of something gone wrong in this midrashic marriage between God and the Jewish people. And that's what this story, Agunot, becomes. Well, this catches the eye of the local rabbi, the local Orthodox rabbi, who was none other than Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, Zecher Tzadek Levracha, Rav Kuk. Rav Kuk, I must say, when we planned this session, I was supposed to be here with my friend Yehuda Mirsky. People read Yehuda's work? Yehuda Mirsky is one of the leading scholars on Rav Kuk. He wrote a book that came out in the Yale Jewish Live series last year, the year before, the most significant intellectual biography of Rav Kuk in English. And we were going to do this thing where we each embodied our figures. But unfortunately, Yehuda had to cancel and he's not here with us. So I was left to pick up the bag. People that are interested in learning more about Rav Kuk, I warmly, warmly recommend Yehuda's biography. You were involved with that? You're involved? You're not involved. Rav Kuk was this, and it's hard to describe in adequate terms the absolute innovation that Rav Kuk put forth on the Jewish scene. He was completely traditionally schooled. He was a mystic. Oh, that's the subtitle of his book, Mystic in Time of Revolution. He was drawn to Eretz Yisrael. To call him a Zionist is something of an anachronism, but we would refer to him as a Zionist. He leaves the world after studying, of course, in yeshivot in Europe, serving as a small town rabbi in Europe. He answers the call to come on Aliyah, and he becomes the rabbi of Jaffa, which was then the center of Jewish life in Ottoman Palestine. The young people that came, they came to Yafo. From there, perhaps they went off and started a kibbutz or started a farming settlement. Jerusalem was the bastion of the old yeshuv, the traditionalists, the old world, what today we would call the Haredim, but again, that's also anachronistic. And Rav Kuk thought that part of our national return to the land was not just the physical return of picking up and getting on a boat and arriving and building a society and a civilization leading to an autonomous state, but it was returning to ourselves. The topic of tshuva, return, what we colloquially translate as repentance, does not fully capture what he thought the return to the Jewish people was about. Yes, he thought it was also about a return to traditional observance, to Torah study, to all of those things, but it was also about a return to ourselves. So he takes great interest in the young people in Yafo and in the secular culture that was going up about him, and as opposed to the more conventional knee-jerk right-wing response to secularism, he sees something important, significant, and holy in these young secular Jews, because he says they are building our world, they are building our society, our civilization, and that's a religious value, whether they know it or not, whether they admit it or not. I've done a disservice by summarizing it that way, but that's the central idea you have to keep in the front of your head for the next 40 minutes. I'm sorry, there doesn't seem to be enough. We can share, and again, if you have the app, you can access it on the app. Agnon develops this very close relationship with Rav Kuk, even though at that time, as I told you, Agnon had moved away from traditional observance. later he would come back to it. The picture from his old age, this photo, which until last year was the photo on the 50 shekel bill in Israel, this photo has him in older age with his big black yarmulke returned to his head. But at this period in his youth, from the time he arrives until 1924, after having gone out of Israel for a period of time to Germany, getting married, having two children, and then returning, and when he returns the second time, the yarmulke, the kippah, returns to his head. And he never gives a clear explanation for why he took it off and why he put it back on. He once told this very fabulous tale about the ghost of Maimonides coming to him and telling him, "No, Shmuel Yosef, can't you wear a yarmulke?" Only in an Agnon story would the Rambam speak with a Yiddish accent. But these are the fables that he wove about himself and his biography. Later in life, in a kind of recollection of those years, Agnon wrote, this is the first source on the sheet, "Rabbeinu HaGadol, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk Zal, how close he drew me in. In his humility, he was kind enough to read my story, V'haya Ha'akov L'mishur." I'll come back to explain what that is in a second. "Which was then still in manuscript. When he returned it to me, he said in these exact words, 'This is a Zehu Sipur Ivri Be'emet.' This is a true Ivri." Now, Ivri is a term that means Hebrew. In conventional Hebrew, in modern-day Hebrew, to say something is Ivri, it means it's Hebrew. But Ivri also means Jewish. So Rav Kook was playing off of it. It carries both meanings. This is an authentic Hebrew story. This is an authentic Jewish story flowing through the divine channels without any barrier. Noveya minat sinarot below shum mechitza, whatever that means. It's a Kabbalistic idea, but it's definitely the kind of thing you want to put on, you know, the book jacket. I'm sorry? It would be, except in other words, in Rav Kook's lexicon, right. Ivri is a term which means both Hebrew, meaning the Hebrew language, the Hebrew people, and Jewish. You have to remember, this is a time when Hebrew itself is a language in transition. I mean, Rav Kook, like Agnon, used a whole lexicon of words which weren't even contemporary in their own time, certainly not in ours. And that was part of the innovation of what Agnon was doing, was inventing a language as it was flowing out of his pen. And the language wars that took place in Eretz Yisrael in those days about what direction Hebrew should go, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who is referred to as the reviver of modern Hebrew, was not a beloved character to Agnon or to Agnon's friend Bialik, because they said he didn't revive any. You can't revive something that's not dead. Hebrew was not dead. Maybe it was in the deep freeze and needed to be defrosted. But it wasn't dead. It was always the language of scholarship. It was always the language of prayer. It was always, as Hillel Halkin once said, Hebrew was always the second language of every Jew. Asterisk, it's not true. Didn't include necessarily the women. Didn't include necessarily certain very unlearned people, but you understand the point. Hebrew was always the second language of the Jewish people wherever they were. In Eastern Europe, Yiddish was the first language. In places, Ladino was the first language. In places, English was the first language. But Hebrew was always the second language of every Jew, but the first language of none. And Hillel points out the irony that today, Hebrew is the first language of more Jews than any other, but it is the second language of nearly no Jews. Because the state of Hebrew today is not what it ought to be. Not what it ought to be. Why did Rav Kook think that Agnon's writing was so significant in this way? Because he felt that part of the national return, part of building a state, it was not just about building roads, and not just about digging ditches, and not just about making hospitals, and not just about having a defense force, which will later become an army, etc., 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 etc. It was about recapturing our culture. Now, you might think, that's the one thing we had. We went into the exile, and we traveled with and in the book. Right? The book the book meaning the Torah, but the book meaning the entirety of the Jewish bookshelf, the canon, became our portable home in the text. And we had a culture. And now we've come back, and what we need is a place to live and roads to drive on and hospitals to birth babies in and an army to protect us from our enemies. And Rav Kook said, no. What we had in the diaspora all those years was a kind of attenuated culture. It was Jewish life and culture in the influence, under the imprint of general life and culture, this whatever the host societies we lived in. And now, we all have a host society. Asterisk, you can never put culture into a centrifuge and separate it out into its disparate parts. And even after coming back, it's possible to say that the Jewish people like created some kind of pure, unadulterated culture. And you might even say that it would be folly to try to do so. It would be impossible to do so, particularly in our, I don't know, global village. And the idea of creating an authentic Sipur Ivri Amiti, an authentic Jewish tale, that's going to be part of it. So Rav Kook looks to the young authors and the young poets and the artists. He took this interest when they found the Bezalel School of Art in Yerushalayim, that this would be a positive development, a return to the arts. In the latter days, when there was an attempt to protect Rav Kook from himself and to show that he was frumer than you might have thought, there's been an attempt to censor some of Rav Kook's writings, to soften the positive things he says about particularly the visual arts, because the visual arts were always viewed with a certain amount of suspicion in religious society. But even positive things that he says about sculpture, which was never a traditionally Jewish art form, positive things says about sculpture are on the record, even though that's one of the examples of the attempt to censor Rav Kook and to erase the record. In Yehuda, in your book, he addresses this quite well. The second passage on the sheet, which I apologize, unfortunately we don't have it in English. It really is one of the most important pieces of Rav Kook that has yet to be translated. It's a short essay called Ma'amar Hador, an essay about the generation. It's written in 1906. It's written in 1906, shortly before Agnon arrives, shortly after Rav Kook himself had arrived. And he looks at these secular Jews in Palestine, and he puts forth this idea that they're holy, that they're doing holy work. It needs to be redeemed. And he says, if it looks like they're rebelling, if it looks that they're going against, and this in fact was the case. In other words, like Agnon himself, you know, young men came from traditional world and abandoned ritual observance, even though they were involved in the founding of the Jewish state. And he says, I'll just grossly summarize, you see in the bold, he says, Ki mahu akoach hapoel et kol hashinuim hanimratzim bekirbo, shebeglalam anachnu kol kach sovlim im lo hasifrut. Literature is something with great power. There's great imaginative power. He refers to the type of literature that these young men, and they were almost exclusively young men, there was a tremendous gender imbalance amongst the young people that had come in Aliyah in terms of the amount of men versus the amount of women. It was a young woman's market. She had her choice of the pick. He said he looks at the literature that these people are reading. It's not clear exactly who he's referring to. Presumably he's talking about the Russian authors, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, others. And he says, we need to create something that's going to have the same kind of force and imaginative pull from within Jewish sources. Now, we're not talking about a kind of art scroll novel. There are such things available today. where there'll be no sex and no passion and no sin, and the whole thing kind of reads like a novelized version of, well, I would say the Mesilat Yesharim, which was a great early modern ethical work, except in the Mesilat Yesharim itself there is sex and sin and all those other things, and we're of course frumer than those rabbis were today, but this kind of kosherfied literature, right? Kosherfied literature. A friend of mine in Yerushalayim, a colleague of mine, Yoel Finkelman, wrote a very interesting book recently called Kosher Literature, examining this whole phenomenon. You can go into any bookstore in Yerushalayim, presumably here as well, a Jewish bookstore, and find these kinds of, novels for the Orthodox community. And, they've been sanitized of anything. You know what happens when you sanitize literature like that? You don't get a very good book. Because what makes for compelling literature? Conflict, right? Someone who wrestles with sin. And sometimes the character will come out on top, and sometimes he will fall and stumble. But, in Hasidic literature, which is something that Agnon played off of on Wednesday when we show the films. I'll come back to that. Have you seen the movie Ushpizen? Yeah. So Ushpizen is based on an Agnon story. And the Agnon story is based on a set of Hasidic tales. But what Agnon does to it causes a transformation that moves it from the Hasidic tale into modern literature. Hasidic tales are, of course, a form of Jewish literature. But they are not modern literature in the sense that they're explicitly didactic. They're there in order to teach a lesson. The simple shoemaker and the water carrier that comes to the Shalashudis and listens to the Rebbe tell the tale is meant to understand what the point was. Ambiguity is not desired. So for example, what's the most famous Hasidic tale? Hasidic Tales 101. Choni Magal is a Talmudic tale. It's a Talmudic tale, although it reads like a Hasidic tale in certain ways.
Seven beggars.
What?
Seven beggars?
No, actually not. Seven beggars is a tale of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who completely transformed the genre. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov really is a modern writer in this regard, and in that way he was a profound influence on Agnon. Agnon is sometimes... was anybody in Daniel's session yesterday? He taught an Agnon story. Daniel taught an Agnon story from a cycle called the Sefer HaMa'asim, which are these very surrealistic tales. People read them and say there's an obvious influence of Kafka here. Agnon claimed that he had never read Kafka, never heard of him. In the Agnon House Library today, there's a very well-worn edition of the collected writings of Kafka. When someone asked him, I thought you said, he looks at me and he says, must be my wife's. What he meant was that Kafka wasn't an influence on him, because he was already writing in a Kafka-esque style before he would have encountered Kafka. If two things look alike, it doesn't necessarily point to an influence. They both may be generative of something earlier. And in this case, they both were influenced by Rabbi Nachman, who has this... The genre that we call Kafkaesque is only because Kafka himself kind of brought it to a level of perfection and put a stamp on it. But Kafka did not invent the surreal genre. And it's already there. Now, Kafka, of course, couldn't really properly read Hebrew. Kafka read Rabbi Nachman's tales in Buber's German translation. That's how he came to it. Agnon, of course, read it in the original Hebrew and Yiddish. When Rav Kook looks to the young Agnon's writings, he sees what he's looking for. He sees this is the kind of cultural product that we need to revivify the Jewish people, the Jewish heart, the Jewish imagination. Not because it's a Hasidic tale. What's that Hasidic tale? What's that classic Hasidic tale? little boy goes to shul, he doesn't know how to daven properly. In one version of the story, he takes out a little flute and he blows on it, and the people all yell. In the story, it's usually Rosh Hashanah, meaning, you know, they're all blowing a shofar, he's blowing a flute, and they all yell at him, and the Baal Shem Tov says, "No, Yidden, don't you understand? His prayer, which comes from the heart, is more sincere than yours." In another version of the story, which may not have liked the kind of antinomian element of playing a musical instrument on Shabbat, the story has changed to, he doesn't know how to pray, all he knows is the Aleph Bet. So he goes to shul, and everybody's davening, and he's saying, Aleph Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Ches, Tes, Yud. And they all start yelling at him, and he says, "Well, I don't know how to pray, but God can put the letters together and make the prayers himself." And they yell at him, and the Baal Shem says, "No, don't you know?" This story has no ambiguity to it. Everybody hears the story and knows exactly what it is. In that way, it's like Aesop's fables, right? There are the ants and the grasshoppers and blah, blah, blah. And then usually in most printed editions of Aesop's fables, it tells you the bottom, in case it wasn't clear, in case we need to fully unpack this metaphor, let me tell you, here is the moral of the story. It's a form of literature, but it is pre-modern literature. Modern literature is marked by, among other things, this ambiguity, this question. What's going on here? Is he right or is he wrong? How do we judge and evaluate the character's methods and his and what he's trying to achieve and what means he takes to get there? Right? There aren't too many black and white, pure tzaddikim or pure rishaim, holy righteous or holy wicked characters in good literature. In children's literature, there can be. But in good literature, there aren't, because it doesn't make for particularly engaging literature. V'hayakov l'mishor, the story that Agnon gave Rav Kook to read in manuscript, is a story which on its surface reads like a kind of hybrid of a Talmudic case and a Hasidic tale. It's about a young pauper named Menashe Chaim. Agdon loved to put a kind of midrashic spin on the title, on the characters' names. Menashe Chaim. Menashe means to forget. And Chaim means life. He's kind of like forgotten while alive. He goes off a schnorring because he and his childless wife, they've lost their parnassa, they've lost their livelihood. And he goes out to schnorr. He goes around to the outlying towns. Long story short, he's mistaken for dead. The rabbi mistakenly allows his wife to remarry. It's the opposite of an aguna case. She really is an aguna. She can't remarry. Her husband is alive. We just don't know where he is. But because of a mistake, the rabbi allows his wife to remarry. She remarries. He shows up back in town on the day of her son's Brit Milah. He understands, of course, the reason they hadn't had children all the years he was with her was his fault. So what does he do? If he reveals himself, he creates a terrible problem. The child is a mamzer, is a halachic bastard. Her second marriage is kaput. It happens that he himself is a kohen. And because of the halachic technicalities, she can neither return to him. He goes off to the cemetery. And he kind of lives this half-life on the periphery in the cemetery until he kind of just dies of sorrow. And he's buried under an anonymous grave. The narrator tells us that the wife who... I mean, according to the wife, as far as the wife knew, he'd already died way back when. And she goes to the town where she had been told that he had died. It was a case of mistaken identity. Someone else, some other pauper had died. Again, long story short, it was a case of mistaken identity. That pauper was buried. So she goes back to the cemetery and she wants to put... She's now married, remarried, she has a child, but she wants to put a gravestone over her late husband's grave. Now that she's remarried and is on her feet, she can now afford it. But where is she going to put it? She's going to put it over the grave of the fellow who was mistaken for our Menashe Chayim, the grave digger, who was the only one that knew the story, fixed it so that the grave found its proper place. This is not exactly, and I've greatly considered, the story itself, the Hayakov Lemishor, is now being translated. If you, on the back of the sheet, one of the things that I'm involved in is putting out new editions of Agnon's stories in new English translations. So there at the bottom is from Korain Publications, from Toby Press, you know, the printing house in Yerushalayim that does all of your Rabbi Sachs's books these days. So you can see the catalog of the books, although I think many of them will be for sale here. So this story, which was first published in 1912, and really established him as the dominant rising figure in the world of new Hebrew literature, this story is only now being translated for the first time. It'll come out next year under the title, "And the Crooked Shall Be Made Straight." Rav Kook looks at the story and says, "Zehu Sipur Ivri Amiti." Zehu Sipur Ivri Amiti. This is an authentic Jewish tale. It is. It's an authentic modern Jewish tale, because it's not a Musar book. It's not something. It's not the guide for the perplexed. It doesn't answer your religious questions. On the contrary, it should raise more questions than it answers. But it's authentic in the sense that it emanates from the world of traditional Jewish life. It's written in Agnon's highly lyrical and stylized Hebrew, which is a distillation of the entire canon of Jewish writing from the Bible, particularly in the language of Chazal, the language of the Mishnah and the Midrash, through medieval Hebrew literature, poetry, Hasidic tales. He kind of took all of that, distilled it down, cast it into the mold of modern literature, and created a new genre. Created a new genre that still influences Hebrew literature today in different ways. And that's what Rav Kook thought was significant, and that's what he thought was going to advance the cause of Jewish life and culture. Yes, ma'am. Okay. It could be, but it still creates this tension, because the demands of the halakha are one thing, and the kind of moral impulse that a character or his reader feel create this tension, right? If somebody reads the story and says, "Oh, obviously Agnon was saying that our moral sense trumps the halachic demand," they've misunderstood the story. That's the conclusion of the story. But the point is the tension. The point is wrestling with that. And even if we, contemporary readers, no longer live, although some of us do, no longer live in a world where the demands of the halakha are absolute, we have to understand that these are stories that are written about a world where that was the case. To what can it be compared? You can go to Italy, you can go to Rome, and you can visit the churches, and you can see the church art. I'm not a Catholic, I'm not even a Christian. I don't believe in any of their symbols. I don't believe in their theology or their whole belief system. But I can't appreciate that art unless I understand that it both emanates from a particular belief system and is meant to be a symbol to foster that kind of veneration. Right? But if I can't understand that these were created, not always, but they were often created by artists who were deeply rooted within that belief system and were installed in these churches in order to foster it, so then I'm going to be missing something when I'm looking at the Sistine Chapel. The same thing with, it's not an exact comparison, the same thing with Agnon. It's written from within, despite the fact that when this particular story was written, he was not ritually observant. Although Gershom Scholem, the famous scholar of Kabbalah, who was a close friend of Agnon, said that he knew Agnon at different periods in his life. In the period when he was not ritually observant, he still telegraphed the weight of tradition. And later in life, when he returned to traditional observance, he still maintained a completely open mind of a secularist. He was this kind of contradiction. He was this complicated character, as great people of the imagination and artists tend to be. If Rav Kook was such an influence on Agnon, and thought so highly of him, Agnon wrote, again, in a variety of genres, but Agnon wrote much of his work situated in the world of the Second Aliyah. Where is Rav Kook? He doesn't write exactly historical novels, but he populates his stories with historical events, with historical characters. And Rav Kook is not really there. I mean, there are indications in the stories that Rav Kook exists, that within the fictional world created by Agnon, in his great novel T'mol Shel Shom, Only Yesterday, they're walking around Yafo in 1908, 1909, 1910, and at one point, for no particular reason, one character is giving directions to another character and says, you make a left and then you make a right, and then you go past Rav Kook's house, and then you'll find where you're going. Right? It's almost just a way of it does nothing in the story, there's nothing in the plot. But it's a way of kind of saying that in this fictional world that I've created, Rav Kook lives there also. And you don't have to do it that way. You can write a story which is situated in an actual time and place. It looks a lot like our world, but it's not exactly our world. Right? In other words, think of some movie you've seen where it's taking place in the contemporary United States. It's post 9/11. They're dealing with ISIS or with terrorism or something like that. But the president is not named Barack Obama. The president in this world, this fictional world, which looks a lot like our world, is obviously based on our world, but it is not exactly, because we know who's sitting in the White House now, and that's not this character that's been created in the story. But everything else might be exactly the same. They didn't feel it necessary to fictionalize the name of this organization, ISIS, right? They could have done that. They could have created something else. So in Agnon's fictional universe, Rav Kook is there, but he's not there. We never see him. There are, however, a few characters. There are a few characters who very clearly are serving as mouthpieces for, if not for Rav Kook, then for his worldview. And that's what Agnon was telegraphing. Throughout his life, Rav Kook died in 1935. Agnon died in 1970. They maintained a relationship throughout. There's a story. Has anybody who's visited the Beit Agnon, the Agnon House in Jerusalem? Well, next time you come to Jerusalem, come and visit. But in his house, the house where he lived and wrote for much of his life, which has been kind of restored as a museum, as a study center. So there's this very old, it's hard to call it an easy chair by our standards, but it's a more comfortable type chair. So there's a story that's told about this chair that one night Rav Kook came to visit, like in the 30s. He was already quite an old man. He died in 1935. And it does this, he would walk. Rav Kook lived in what today is the Rav Kook House, which is in the center of town off of Rehov Yafo. And Agnon lived all the way out in Talpiot. And one night there's a knock on the door, and Agnon's daughter, who just passed away last summer, Agnon's daughter writes in her memoirs that one night there's a knock on the door. She was a little girl. She opens the door. She said, and there was a giant standing there, right? To a little girl, he looked like a giant. It was Rav Kook who had come to visit Agnon. So Agnon lived a very, even though he had a very good deal, he was able to really dedicate himself fully to writing. We mentioned Kafka earlier, besides the fact that Kafka was already dead by the time he was younger than any of us, which is so depressing, isn't it? Kafka died before he was 40, I think. Is that correct?
41.
He died of tuberculosis. He had a bit, but he had to work. He had to get up every day, and he worked in insurance. He was a clerk in insurance agents. You can understand like why he liked bureaucracy and form filling, and that became like the symbol of like the oppression of modernity in Kafka's writing. And all of his writing he had to do on the side. Agnon, throughout most of his career, was able to dedicate himself to the largesse of Mr. Shokin, of the Shokin Publishing House, who became his patron, was able to dedicate himself fully to writing. But they lived a simple kind of life, as did most people in Jerusalem in those days. So there's this one comfortable easy chair. So if Cook comes to visit, Agnon says to him, Kvod HaRav, Bavakasha, please sit down. And Rav Kook looks around and sees it's the only comfortable chair in the house. The other chair is like a folding wooden, like a bridge chair. So he says, no, it's not right. You're the Bal HaBayit. This is your home. You should sit on the comfortable chair. And this goes back and forth. They spend the whole evening talking while standing up. When he leaves, Agnon says to him, please, Rav Kook, come and visit again. He said, I will, when you buy another chair. So they maintain this relationship, but he's largely in T'mol Shel Shom, in Only Yesterday, which is set in the world of Yafo and Yerushalayim of the Second Aliyah, meaning the period leading up to World War I. There's a character named Menachem HaOmed. He's called HaOmed, the stander, because he's always standing. He never sits down because he's committed to this kind of... He's a truly noble character, one of the few in Agnon. And in every scene, you see him there with his Gemara under one hand and a pitchfork in the other, ready to go out and do the work of the land and Torah Avodah and this kind of dual commitment that Rav Kook was arguing for. You see, here's a character, a truly noble figure who fulfills this kind of vision for things, and it's not hard to imagine that he's somehow telegraphing the values, although he's not meant to be a fictionalized version of Rav Kook. In Agnon's maybe his greatest achievement as a novelist, a 1939 work called Oreach Natal Lalun, A Guest for the Night, is the story of an author who we, the reader, are clearly meant to believe is a fictionalized version, a projection, an autobiographical projection of Agnon into his own work, who, after living in Yerushalayim for a number of years, goes back to his old hometown. The story, published in 1939, it's published the beginning of September 1939 in the Haaretz newspaper, which has the ad advertising, new on the bookshelf. There were other things going on September 1st, 1939. But the headline in the newspaper is actually, the Germany invades Poland, but the French are going to take care of it. So there are other things going on in the world. This story is set in 1930. And it's actually based on a biographical incident where Agnon did go back. The only real extended visit that he made to his old hometown after having left as a 19-year-old. And it really is a case like Twain, like Faulkner, like Philip Roth, who if you've read Philip Roth, my mother was a little younger than Roth, and she grew up in Newark, New Jersey, in this same Jewish neighborhood, the Weak Wake section of Newark, New Jersey, where Roth grew up. And all those stories are set in her youth. So when I was a kid, like, we had to read these things, even though they're a little dirty, because like I had to understand where she had come from. But these authors who kind of leave their hometown, you can take the boy out of Buchach, but you can't take Buchach out of the boy. He'd never really stepped foot there from the time he was 19 until his 80s. But for 60 years, he was writing about it. He was living it. He was reconstructing it. And this visit that he makes back to Buchach in 1930 becomes a novel called Oreach Natal Alun, A Guest for the Night, that is set over the course of a year. The writer has come from Jerusalem. He spends about a year in this town, and it's a description of the town and of Jewish life between the wars and how everything has disintegrated spiritually, economically, mentally, emotionally, religiously, culturally. Right? It's and the fact that the book itself is published on the eve of World War II really highlights for us the idea that the writing was on the wall. Before the first furnace was lit in Auschwitz, Jewish society was already a crumble. That doesn't in any way mitigate the crime of the Holocaust, you understand? So in A Guest for the Night, there's a scene where the guest goes to visit the local town rabbi. And as was the case, many of the local town rabbis were more to the right of their congregants, and Zionism was not a given, and the local town rabbi is a voice for the anti-Zionistic agenda. And again, this being published in 1939, when we know what would have happened if all these people had come on Aliyah beforehand, only makes it all the more tragic. So here's a snippet from the conversation in chapter 31. "What do you say?" said the rabbi. "Did I not out-argue them thoroughly?" They're talking about a kind of pilpul, a kind of debate that he'd been having with other characters. "What shall I say?" said I. "I am from the land of Israel, and the scholars in the land of Israel study the Torah for its own sake, the Shema. And it makes no difference who out-argues whom, for their only purpose is that things should be made plain and the law should be clearly established." The rabbi grasped his beard angrily and said, "And your people are all righteous? V'amech kulam tzadikim, I suppose? And those quarrels and feuds, the slandering, the talebearing we hear about from there, all these are only meant to clarify the law of the Torah? Even the Zionists are ashamed of you." "It's a punishment from heaven," said I, "because they oppose the kingdom of the house of David. But though there are numerous men of strife in Jerusalem," meaning people that make argument, people that have machloket, "there are more men of peace who deny themselves and forego the honor due them, who study the Torah in poverty and rejoice at sufferings, and because of their love of the Torah, do not feel all the troubles that befall them. Their actions are as goodly as their learning, and all their deeds are sincere, and their prayers are as goodly as their actions. I will show you a congregation of pious men in Jerusalem who spend all their day in prayer, seeking nothing for their own affairs, but only that his blessed name, God, be magnified in the world he has created. Some men are privileged to pray such a prayer once in 70 years, and some once a year, but they pray in this way 3 times a day. And what do your young men do?" said, "What do your young men do?" said the rabbi. "Ah, as for the young men of Israel," I said, "may I myself serve as expiation for their sins. They do not study like the scholars or pray like the pious men, but they plow and they sow and plant and give their lives for the land of the Lord swore, the land the Lord swore to give to our forefathers. That is why they have been privileged to have the Holy One, blessed be He, appoint them as guardians over His land." Those are the secularists, the non-religious, right? They don't pray. He says, "I have to admit," in this debate he's having with the rabbis, I admit it. They're not in the Beit Midrash and they're not in the Beit Knesset, but they're out there plowing and sowing and reaping, and they're also defending the land. They're serving in the defense forces. And when they do that, it's because they've been privileged by God to serve as a guardian of the land. Because they give their lives to the land, He's entrusted the land to them. Now, in the manuscript version of this story, Agnon's manuscripts were put into the National Library, and scholars can look at them. In the manuscript version of the story, the narrator, this first-person narrator, this Agnon projection, puts this into the mouth of Rav Kook, or takes this out of the mouth of Rav Kook. There's an explicit reference here to Rav Kook's teachings on the matter, which was removed for the final edition of the story, and we could speculate on a whole variety of reasons of why he might want to do that. It was speculated that he felt he couldn't fictionalize Rav Kook. He could represent his views, but the idea of somehow putting this holy figure into his stories was just not something he was prepared to do. The rabbi's eyes filled with tears, but he paid no heed to his tears and said, "And what about Shabbat?" And they go back and forth arguing about the merits. He's this is like a showstopper. This is what, are you kidding me? These young boys, they're there, they're defending the Jewish people in the Jewish land that God has given us. And the rabbi's just nicking away at all of their merits. Ah, but they don't keep Shabbat. Ah, but they speak in the holy tongue. This Hebrew has a value. That's taken from later in the novel. What happens is the central family in this town, and it's a sprawling novel with dozens of characters. And the new edition that we put out, the novel's actually, the new edition we put out will be on sale here. I get no royalties, so it doesn't matter to me. But I put a cast of characters in the back because there's just so many characters to keep track of. But the central family is this family called Bach. And the elder figure, Rav Shlomo Bach, who's a something of a broken man, but he maintains his integrity. I mean, he's suffered terrible tragedies. One son has been maimed terribly in World War I. He has a sick, kind of like a Tiny Tim-type child. Another son had gone on Aliyah and was killed in the Arab riots in 1929. And he is one of the few people in the town that maintains his faith during the trauma and crisis that have visited over the 15 years prior. At the end of the novel, he goes on Aliyah to Ramat Rachel, the kibbutz, which is actually right next to, in Jerusalem, right next to Agnon's home. When the narrator returns at the end of the novel, he goes out to visit this Reb Shlomo Bach. And Reb Shlomo Bach, in words that are almost lifted straight out of Rav Kook, tells him he's an old man now, and he's there almost like on retirement. So he says, what do you do all day? He goes there, he sees he's working in the garden. He says, how did you come to work in the garden? I asked him. Ah, when I came to Ramat Rachel, he replied, and saw that they were all engaged in settling the land, I said to myself, everyone is engaged in settling the land, and I'm doing nothing. So I asked them to make me a teacher of the children, or a chazan, a cantor in our little congregation. But the old men have no need for a permanent cantor, because each of them knows how to lead the service, and the children have their own teachers, and they don't need this old man. When I saw that I was superfluous, I felt as if the world had darkened. So I lighted the gloom with the Torah and immersed myself in the Mishnah. So I went and I sat and I learned Torah. When I reached the Masechtot to deal with the religious duties that are linked to the soil of the land of Israel, I saw that my learning was rootless. You know, 1/6 of the Mishnah deals with agricultural law, the tithes and Shemitah and all the things connected to the produce of the land of Israel. And outside of Israel, we study it because we study Torah. Torah study, it doesn't matter if it's practical or impractical. It's a halakha that can be fulfilled now, or is just something that's in the realm of the theoretical. Like we study the laws of the sacrifices in the ancient holy temple. We don't perform sacrifices today, but still it is Torah study. But here he is, he's returned to the land. And he realizes his study is rootless. I'd studied these matters abroad and found no difficulty in them. But once I got to the land of Israel, a man's mind is renewed, and he is not content with his earlier interpretations. And here's the passage which is lifted straight out of something in Rav Kook, where Rav Kook talks about Torat Eretz Yisrael, how Torah study in the land of Israel is qualitatively different than outside of the land of Israel. Once I said to myself, let me go and see, what is this tree of which the sages spoke? And what is this field that is mentioned in the Mishnah? This is a reference to a well-known Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, that if somebody is studying Torah and he says, oh, look how lovely that tree is. Oh, look how lovely that field is. He's culpable with his life. Because when you're studying Torah, you shouldn't be distracted by the world. But here, the distraction by the world is itself Torah study. When you're in the land of Israel, the land becomes the text. I heard the young men talking to each other, and through their words, the entire subject became clear. It was not that they were referring to the Mishnah, but they spoke in unusual about trees and plants. I said to myself, wisdom cries outdoors. That's a verse in Proverbs. After that, whenever I found a difficulty in the words of the Mishnah, I would go to one of our chavirim, one of our comrades in the kibbutz. If he did not know, then the gardener knew. If he did not know how to explain our way, he explained it in his own way and showed me every single thing in every tangible fashion. And then I came to realize, Ein Torah Ketorat Eretz Yisrael. There is no Torah like the land of Israel. And that's how I came to be an old man gardener, a gentleman farmer in the land of Israel, because farming becomes a type of fulfillment of Torah study. We only have one moment left. There is one place where Agnon almost explicitly refers to Rav Kook. There's a short story which was only published. It was only collected posthumously. It's not well known and hasn't been translated. I have a few copies of it here in Hebrew, and in the source sheets that are in the guidebook online, you have the text also. The story is called Hataba'at o Maaseh She'en Lo Sof, and it carries a little preface that the author writes, which is quite unusual for Agnon. And he says, the whole thing is a mashal. It's a kind of agada. It's a type of metaphor, a parable. And he says, you could interpret it this way. You could interpret it that way. It's a story of it's a kind of cross between a Hasidic tale and J.R.R. Tolkien, if you can believe that. It's the whole thing is one page. It takes place at a chuppah. There's a bride and a groom. The groom had gone to buy the ring for the wedding, but he didn't know he had bought a magical ring that turns you invisible when you wear it, right? He's gotten Bilbo's ring. The Rav is performing the wedding. The groom puts the ring on the finger of the bride. Poof, she disappears. Everybody's bela. Efo akala, efo akala. So she can hear them. What? Pass them around. There's a few of them, but they're all online. So she can hear them, and they can hear her, but they can't see her. So there's a whole tumult. So she starts banging herself on the head. The ring slips off, and here she is again. The groom bends down, picks up the ring. When he's looking at the ring, it slips onto his finger. He disappears. He disappears. So they all say, "Where's the groom? Where's the groom?" Same thing. The ring slips off his finger. The rabbi finishes the drasha. All the while, the whole story kind of serves as a midrash, a literary midrash, on the brachot of the sheva brachot that we say under the chuppah. When he's done, the rabbi realizes the ring has slipped back into his finger. I assure you, Agnon did not know Tolkien. You know, but just like Bilbo slips the hand into his pocket, what's it got in its pockets, my precious? Right? The ring goes onto the Rav's finger, the Rav disappears. So Agnon says in this kind of methodological preface, look, weddings, that's about God and the Jewish people. And maybe it's also about two people coming together. No, there's nothing more illogical than a wedding. Everybody's an individual. Everybody's unique. This idea that we're going to like bond ourselves in marriage to someone else is a kind of odd idea. But it works. And he says, maybe it's also about, he doesn't name him, he says, that great figure about whom, may I? Oh no, who was the Hebrew text? Who took the Hebrew text? He says, maybe it's about V'yesh b'zeh od mashal v'dimyon l'mi she'en kol lashon shel mashal v'dimyon nofel alav. Maybe it's a parable about he who cannot be parabolized, because we can't refer to him in that way, and that's Rav Kook. How is this? Well, I'll leave that to you. You can try to unpack the parable and the metaphor. I'm around all week. I'm happy to talk to you about it over dinner. How this story is a metaphor for Rav Kook. We have time for one question, and then we have to let someone else do it.
The first specific story that you referenced about the boy who played the flute in the shul.
Yeah.
And then later you talked about the rabbi who's questioning why these secular Jews are working rather than praying. It seems to be quite a similar story, but the only difference is that the rabbi in the first case realizes that they actually have intention and their prayer is genuine.
Right. Well, it's in that way, it's a. In other words, the rabbi character in the Agnon story is he's a buffoon. In other words, he's.
Do you think he's caricaturing the religious way of thinking more in his story?
Because also. For sure. I'm not sure that it's deliberately playing off of that particular Hasidic tale, but it's playing off of that particular religious value.
Okay.
Thank you. Good. Thank you all.